Welcome to SCOTUScast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Hello and welcome to SCOTUScast. I'm your host, Justin Drewer, on behalf of the Faculty Division of the Federalist Society. We're here today to discuss Smith v. United States, which was argued before the court on March 28th. It's my honor to introduce our guest today, Professor Brian Cult. Professor Cult is a professor of law and the Harold Norris Faculty Scholar at Michigan State University. His research focuses on structural constitutional law, especially provisions concerning the presidency, like elections, impeachment, pardons, and the 25th Amendment, and on juries, which bears on the case today. So, Professor Cult, thank you for joining us today. And how about we start off by talking about why this case matters or what's interesting about the case that that should keep our audience's attention?
Sure. Well, Smith versus United States deals with venue, which is not the first thing that comes to mind when people think about constitutional criminal procedure. But the Constitution does specify, and the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure do specify, that the defendant has a right to a trial in the venue where the crime was committed. And so the question in the case is, what happens when the government doesn't prove that venue is appropriate, doesn't prove that the defendant did anything in the place where the trial is being held? There's a circuit split on this, and some circuits have said, in that case, the government fails to make its case, just like any other thing where they fail to make their case, then the defendant is acquitted, and they can't be re-prosecuted because of double jeopardy. The other circuits that have looked at this have said, no, this is just a technical matter, and the government can try again in a proper venue. This doesn't come up all that often. It's not a major criminal procedure issue that people have been waiting for years for the Supreme Court to resolve this, thousands of cases. But it does present, I think, some interesting philosophical questions and broader technical questions about what the government needs to do to prosecute someone, what ability they have to make mistakes and then fix them, to what extent is the goal of prosecuting someone successfully more important than the goal of following constitutional requirements that in most cases are pretty simple. In this case, it wasn't. What we have here is fundamental question of what venue is. Is it just a technical matter, or is it an essential part of the crime? And there's a Federalist small f, not Federalist Society, but a Federalist issue here about the interests of the jurisdictions themselves. If they prosecute in the wrong place, then what happens to the place where the crime was committed? What happens to the interest of that community? So all of these issues about venue and vicinage, which I've written about, which is where the jury is from, are brought to bear in this case. And it was very interesting for me as someone who's written about this. There aren't a lot of people who write about venue and vicinage, and to see the court wrestle with these issues was a lot of fun, because they don't take that many cases on this issue.
Well, I think that segues perfectly into the oral argument. So are there any surprises that happened or any key takeaways that you'd like to touch on from the oral argument?
Yeah, so I thought the oral argument was surprising to me in a few ways. The arguments differed a little bit from where I thought they would go based on the briefs. And the justice's questions focused in on a couple of things that weren't really briefed. I should, for full disclosure, I should say that I submitted an amicus brief with Professor Drew Kirshen. And Professor Kirshen is I would say, the foremost authority on venue and vicinage and their interrelationship, the Sixth Amendment provision at issue here. And both sides cited his work. So we submitted a brief just on the history, the importance of the venue, right, the origins of it, the importance of it, and why we thought that justified a robust remedy. But the main thrust of the briefing, I thought, was, as I said before, what is venue? Is it more like an element of the crime? So if they don't prove it, that's an acquittal, or is it just some technical procedural thing? And if you get it wrong, you get to do it over. The justices focused a lot more than I expected. I think maybe a lot more than petitioner expected on the double jeopardy question, because there's a whole nuanced body of case law on double jeopardy and when it is implicated in a case. And the briefing didn't really get into double jeopardy nuances at all. It was sort of not an afterthought, but it was sort of peripheral to the discussion. So when they focused in on it as much as they did, I was surprised by that. But what double jeopardy cuts to is this question. So if you have an error in the trial court and you take it up to the Court of Appeals and they say that's right, the defendant was deprived his right to counsel, or this evidence shouldn't have been admitted, or something like that, the remedy is typically a new trial. It doesn't implicate double jeopardy in most cases, and other Sixth Amendment rights the right to counsel, the right to confront your witnesses, those do not give rise to an acquittal. And speedy trial is in the Sixth Amendment, that does. And so I thought the question in the case would be, is the venue right in the Sixth Amendment more like speedy trial, or is it more like right to counsel and right to confront witnesses? Incidentally, and I mentioned I come at this as someone who studies juries, the Sixth Amendment doesn't actually say anything about venue. The court treats it that way and has for some time. And Professor Kirshen's work is all about how venue and vicinage have been conflated. But I just want to step back a little and lay the constitutional groundwork here. So Article 3 of the Constitution says that the venue for a trial has to be in the state where the crime was committed. And it also says that criminal trials are jury trials. The Sixth Amendment says that the jury has to be from the state and district where the crime was committed. It doesn't say that venue is in the district, state and district where the crime was committed, just that the jury has to be drawn from there. But because the venue typically, not always, but typically defines where the jury is from, and where the jury is from, conversely, will usually dictate where the venue is. The federal rules of criminal procedure have interpreted this state and district requirement, this vicinage requirement, as a venue requirement. So the federal rules of criminal procedure specify that the location of the crime determines the location of the trial. It's the state and district under the Sixth Amendment. So it's a Sixth Amendment right. So the justices were sort of confronted with a tangled mess from prior case law on this, because the way that venue has been treated in the past doesn't really, it's neither fish nor fowl. It doesn't really square with either the notion that it's an element of the crime or with the notion that it's just some purely technical consideration. So one thing about it is that the government, the prosecution, has the burden of proving venue. If the defendant says, kind of like an affirmative defense, says venue is improper here, I didn't do anything in this district, then the prosecution has to prove that venue is appropriate. If the defendant doesn't challenge venue, then it's waived. But if venue is an issue, the government has to prove it. But typically, and the Supreme Court has never said this, but the Court of Appeals treat this as something that the government only has to prove by a preponderance of the evidence. So it's not like an element that has to be proven beyond reasonable doubt, but it is something that they have to prove. And if the jury finds that the government didn't make its case, didn't prove venue, then everyone agrees that the proper result there is an acquittal. The issue in this case was the jury said that there was venue. Smith appealed that to the 11th Circuit. The 11th Circuit said, no, there wasn't venue. And the 11th Circuit said the remedy is vacating the conviction and allowing retrial. So I think the strongest argument, the thing that seemed to impress the court the most for the petitioner's side was this idea that if the jury finds it, then it's an acquittal and you can't be re-prosecuted. Why would it be that if the jury should have said that, if the Court of Appeals is saying the jury should have said that, that you wouldn't have the same remedy? The whole idea that this is something that the government has to prove, that it's treated that way, struck some of the justices as a little odd, but it is what it is, and they had to deal with the fact that that's how it that's how it's argued in these cases. I think the strongest argument on the other side came from this double jeopardy idea. If double jeopardy is to be implicated by, you know, so the Court of Appeals throwing out a conviction because of something that the lower court got wrong, it's got to be something that goes to guilt or innocence. So if it's a technicality, right? If the jury was biased, or if the counsel was ineffective, something like that, that doesn't go to whether the defendant did the crime or not. It was about how the trial was run. And so on a blank slate, I think the court probably would have said, well, this is really about how the trial is run. It's not jurisdictional. It's not about what the defendant did or didn't do. It's just, are we in the right place when we have this trial? And so again, on a blank slate, I think they would have said, "Oh, well, this is not the sort of thing that we find in double jeopardy cases bars retrial." However, because of the way venue is treated as something the government has to prove, they couldn't just easily dispose of it that way. Well, maybe they will. We'll have to wait and see what the decision says, but. But that was the conundrum they were wrestling with, and I really can't predict what they're going to do based on their questions. I think for me anyway, it's still up in the air.
Well, that almost teed up my next question of your prediction of the outcome, but it makes sense that it's all still up in the air. So I guess that kind of brings us towards the end of the episode. Do you think there's anything else that's worth covering with this case, or barring a prediction seems like a good unpacking of it? So thank you for that.
Well, I'd like to talk about this particular case and what it sort of shows us about the balance of power between prosecutors and defendants. So Smith, in this case, Timothy Smith, was charged with basically breaking into a website, getting data from a website improperly. And when he did this, he was in Alabama. And the server that he broke into was located in the Middle District of Florida. And there's no question that if he had been charged in Alabama or had been charged in the Middle District of Florida, there would have been no problem at all with venue. But the government charged him in the Northern District of Florida. The only thing that connected the case to the Northern District of Florida is that the company whose server it was located in the Northern District of Florida. And so when we look historically at what this venue right meant to the framers, it meant having the trial where the crime was committed. Usually that meant having the trial where the defendant was from. People usually didn't stray too far from where they live. It prevented the government from choosing a faraway venue like the British did, having people go overseas for the trial, maybe not even having a jury wherever it was. That's not really the issue in this particular case, because dragging him all the way to the Northern District of Florida is what was questioned here, but the Middle District of Florida was even farther away, and there's no question that they could have done that. The modern criminal code, the federal criminal code, allows, in these multi-district cases, allows a lot of leeway, a lot of discretion to the government. They can already choose, without violating the Constitution, they can already choose which forum they think is the best one. And there are things like, where's most of the evidence, where are most of the witnesses, but there's nothing stopping them from also tactically making their decision based on where they think they have the best chance of getting a conviction, which judges, which district has judges that will be most sympathetic, or a jury that would be most sympathetic to their case. So the government already has a lot of power to choose the venue without running afoul of the federal rules or the Sixth Amendment. And the result of that is not much is left for the defendant to hold on to as a right, as a valuable privilege given by the Constitution. So I feel like if the court does say that the government only gets one bite at the apple, that they have a choice, they make their choice, they're stuck with that choice, at least once jeopardy is attached, I think that would restore a little bit of balance, put us a little bit back towards this more defendant-focused structure that the Constitution gives us than we have now. So I think it'll be interesting to see if the court does that, and if they do in their decision, whether they give that as a reason. That the government already has so much power in these multi-district cases that this bright line that the Constitution draws should be enforced strictly.
That is a very interesting point. Thank you for making sure to touch on that. So I think that that's a pretty good summary of the case, unless you think that there's anything else worth mentioning.
No, I think that's probably all I've got to say, other than that it was fun for me to be involved in a case like this again. Back when I was a practicing lawyer back in the 1900s, I used to get involved in cases like these pro bono all the time, and it's been a while, so it was interesting and fun for me, and it's always fun to talk about the great audience like the Federalist Society's SCOTUS Cast.
Well, we've really appreciated having you, and thank you again for joining us.
Well, thank you again.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. SCOTUSCast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's fedsoc.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.